This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Homer and Apple Sauce's minor league podcast. I'm Steve Sipa, and I'm joined this week just by Lucas Vlahos. Unfortunately, Ken and Thomas are not able to join us today, so just the two of us. Lucas,
skeleton crew this week. I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm good. It's unfortunate that at least Thomas isn't here to record with us, because I had a good promote extend trade. Because
oh, did you?
Yeah. I mean, we could do it with you and me, but In 1980, Empire Strikes Back came out.
Indeed it did.
So, who would you promote extend trade of these major characters that were introduced in Empire Strikes Back? We have Boba Fett, Yoda, and Lando Calrissian.
All right, I got a hot take. I'm trading Boba Fett.
I knew you were going to trade Boba Fett.
Yeah, I honestly think, and I say this like having really enjoyed the whole Mandalorian series and like obviously the Mandalorian sprung entirely out of people lore crafting around, oh yeah, that guy in the armor looks cool. Let's come up with that, something for that, because Lord knows George Lucas didn't do it. So the Mandalorian show's great. He got a lot more backstory in the prequels as like a clone, which was interesting. But to be honest, before any of that, people obsessed over this guy and he didn't actually do shit. He shows up, he walks around a bit in Empire Strikes Back, then he goes out like a bitch 10 minutes into New Hope.
Yeah, that was the life and times of Boba Fett were not particularly great.
I never understood why everyone was like, oh man, Boba Fett, yeah. It's like what? Did I miss something?
He looks cool. That's basically...
Yeah, that was it.
It's actually funny. One of the... I'm sure you're aware of this. One of like the bloopers, I guess you could say, of Return of the Jedi is a part on the sailboard when Luke kicks... Dude, and you know, like visibly, you could see that Luke does not actually make
contact.
Does
not actually connect. Yes,
but yet the guy goes flying. So I was watching that on loop, and that takes place when Boba Fett is basically his jetpack is fritzing, and he goes flying in the background and smashes into the sail barge, and then falls into the Sarlacc. So on that GIF in repeat, you just see Boba Fett basically like galleying through the background on his way to his death.
It's not a great, it was not a graceful way to go.
No.
Now I'm going to turn this around with a different question. Do you prefer the original Sarlacc or the modified Sarlacc with the beak added?
I think the modified Sarlacc looks more scary and
really
whatever. Yeah. Because
okay.
The original Sarlacc is just basically a hole with some teeth.
Well, it has the tentacles coming out of it.
But it just, I don't know.
I never liked the beak.
Yeah.
It looked too much like a squid. It was like a squid that's just stuck in the ground. And that's a Sarlacc.
Sarlacc should be more like an antlion than...
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I'm trading Boba Fett. And, I mean, Yoda's the easy extend. Like, come on. What are we doing here?
Yeah. I mean, objectively, Boba Fett is the least important of all of these characters. He's fan attention has probably gotten the most out of all of these guys. But in terms of his on-screen presence, he's not really that important to the storyline.
No. No, Lando's just so damn cool. You know?
That he is.
How did you feel about Yoda and Dooku's fight in Attack of the Clones?
When I saw it in the theater, how old was I? I think I was like 12? No. Like 14, I guess.
Sure.
And at the time, that was the fucking most awesome thing.
Uh-huh.
I remember literally giggling.
Yeah.
Like a little kid, because I was a little kid.
Uh-huh. I was littler than you.
Yeah, that's true. You were probably like 7?
Just something like that, yeah.
Yeah. In retrospect, I'm not a fan.
Really?
Just because I think Yoda should not... I prefer my Yoda to not have a lightsaber, period. It's a symbol of a Jedi, it's a weapon of a Jedi, everything, but, you know, the greatest Jedi does not need to use a lightsaber.
Well, I thought it was... I guess well, you and I have very different Star Wars takes. Like, it's quite interesting, because I actually... like that they fleshed him out as a warrior, and then you see his path to just being a broken old man to a degree, but also like realizing that he doesn't need to fight to be the ideal Jedi that Luke needs. I don't know. I thought it fleshed out, like, he learned from his defeat even at 900 or whoever.
Right.
Like, 900 years old you are. Look, this good day will not.
In the grander scheme of things, I can agree, is that Yoda realized the folly of the Jedi when he was in his, you know, seclusion on Dagobah, and maybe took that next step to become that Jedi that did not need to use weapons. Whereas at the time, I guess, you know, well, he clearly did use his weapon.
I definitely enjoy the fight with Dooku, and then the fight with Palpatine in the Senate is just awesome. I love that whole sequence. Yeah.
I just wish that, I mean, I get thematically why, but I wish that the duel of the heroes and the duel between Yoda and Palpatine were not
spliced. Interwoven?
Yeah.
I like how they kind of build in parallel to each other. And then, of course, John Williams, the most iconic composer of any... here, any since what, like 1950, like his music will live on forever, but as his score swells up, as the main platform is rising up in the Senate, that's like one of my favorite scenes in all of Star Wars, honestly. Like,
oh, you know, I don't disagree at all. I feel like it's like The Godfather 2. You know how in The Godfather 2 you have the not the prequel scenes, the
it's earlier been a long scenes. Time since I've seen The Godfather 2.
Basically, you have the earlier scenes where Don Corleone is a young man turning into Don Corleone, and they're interspliced between, you know, Michael kind of dealing with the same things. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the TV edits and stuff will take all those scenes and just put them in one big block in the beginning. So you see the entire young Don Corleone story, and then
interesting. You
see Godfather 2. Thematically, it's supposed to be, you know, spliced in between, so you see the parallels. Mm-hmm. Similarly with Star Wars, like, you know, it would be nice if you could just see one big block of uninterrupted fighting Anakin and Obi-Wan, Palpatine and Yoda. But, like you say, thematically, you know, it was done in that certain way.
I feel like when you have too long a block of fighting as well, it's a little easier to check out of it almost. And I'm not a filmmaker. This is just my own like personal observation. Like, I don't know. It's like almost more interesting to jump back and forth for a little bit. I do understand what you're saying though. This is a question much more for like actual film critics and not a couple of schmucks like us.
We'll have to get Jeffrey Paternostro. He can give us a definitive answer.
He'll just judge us somewhat fairly for being Star Wars dweebs and then go on about some black and white Japanese film from the 50s.
Then we can talk about Kurosawa and how
love Kurosawa, and it's a huge inspiration for George Lucas as well, so.
Mm-hmm. I guess we should probably get to baseball.
Yeah, I mean, it's less depressing week than last week.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I went to the before you get into the actual minor league stuff, I went to the game on Friday with the game tying grand slam and the extra inning win with my buddy from grad school. It was the most exciting game I've ever seen live. It was great.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell's getting into the actual Mets. Like,
yeah, it sure feels from behind wins. It sure feels like. And look, a lot of this is perception and not reality, and recency bias, et cetera, et cetera. But it sure felt like for a big stretch of the 2022 season and a big stretch of the run in 2015, the Mets would be down late and it wouldn't matter, and they'd somehow win. And then that kind of fell apart for them at the end of 2022, obviously, and it sure as fuck wasn't happening for the start of 2023. But over the past week, they just did it again today.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Starlin Marte hit a two-run home run in the eighth.
First extra base hit since 1974. I don't know. There's that baseball Twitter meme of just wildly oscillating between it's over and we're back. And it's usually, I see it most commonly cited about like Dodgers fans and Philly fans, because that's probably who I follow mostly, and also who they've had some wild swings. But I sure feel like that this past week. I'm like, we're back, baby. Oh no, we're losing again. It's over. Never mind, we're back.
You know, it certainly would have been nice if the Mets hadn't gone like 0-20 the last like 2 weeks, dug themselves into such a hole.
Someone pointed out to me that the Mets went 2-3 against the Dodgers, and then had like a 3-week stretch against some of the worst teams in baseball and paid at like a 70 win pace against them, and then went 2-3 against the Rays. So yep. They bookended it by winning series against the two best teams in baseball and just could not beat the Detroit Tigers.
That's baseball, Susan.
Yeah. The Mets have now won this game.
Awesome. Well, let's go to some college baseball before we get to minor league baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Do some way too early draft updates. My guy, Cole Carrig, his team, San Diego State University, they played 4 games. One was a makeup game against UC San Diego at the beginning of the week, and then they had a weekend series against New Mexico. He went 1-4 with a stolen base against UC San Diego. He went 1-4 with a double and a stolen base in Friday's game against New Mexico. 1-3 with 2 walks and 2 stolen bases on Saturday's game against New Mexico. And because, you know, they're on the West Coast, they are not playing yet with Sunday's game. So all in all, Carrig is 3-11 with a double, 2 walks, 2 stolen bases. And that brings him to a batting line of 313, 403, 476 in 39 games. With 8 doubles, 5 triples, 2 homers, 17 stolen bases, 9 walks, and 22 strikeouts. So, I mean, he's playing, and he's a modicum of productivity right now. So,
how do you spell his last name?
Carrigg.
Thank you. I was butchering that wildly.
But, yeah, would not be unless the Mets were using him as, like, a savings pick with their first-round pick and then had all kinds of weird stuff concocted afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's the only scenario where I'd be like, okay, it's an interesting use, but I don't even think something like that's worth it.
No, not looking great for him at this point.
Nah, he seems more like he's fallen from potentially, like, a 30-40 overall pick to maybe 90, 100, something like that, if even.
Right. I am looking at Prospect Live, their most recent MLB draft top 400 update, and Carrig is at 150. So
yeah, there you go.
Quite a fall.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is this is really no power. He was never a big power guy to begin with. He was always like a hit of a power guy, but 2 home runs. Not really great. He missed a lot of playing time in a division. No, not a division. What do they call it? In a conference, you know, where you're not playing a million games to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And too many strikeouts for the lack of power. I mean,
yeah, the strikeouts are the concerning part to me, honestly.
22 strikeouts in 39 games isn't like horrible, horrible, but when you're not, you know, you're not swinging for the fences, so there shouldn't be this many strikeouts.
Mm-hmm.
At least he's starting to walk a little bit, though, which is also something. Good. Yeah, it's something. He is a far inferior player to Colton Ledbetter, though.
Yes. Not that I'm gloating in it, but yes, Colton Ledbetter this week, he went 6 for 16. So he had been slowing down a little bit, but picked it back up this week. 6 for 16, no homers, 4 walks, did strike out 5 times. He is now batting .320 on the season. His OPS is still over 1,000. We did talk, I think we mentioned last week that Baseball America did a second mock draft and he did not feature in their first round. Mm-hmm. But they also did a staff draft this past week. So not a mock, but like the writers who followed the draft doing a pick and just going through like looping through it, like all 7 of them. And Ledbetter went 27th in that. So I think he's in that range where if you're a fan of him, you're pushing him up into the 20s. And then if you like some other guys more, he's going to slip down into the 30s, the 40s. Prospect Live has him at 35th overall in their most recent update. So still right in that range for the Mets. I think this has been a common refrain. I would not be surprised if he gets popped earlier by the Orioles, the Brewers, the Yankees, I could see the Astros even doing that as well. He kind of fits their analytically inclined profile. I'm tempted to say the Rays, but their hitter picks are always very strange. Let's just put it that way. Like, did not love their selection of Xavier Isaac last year. So I don't know that he really fits them, but there are several analytically inclined hitter angled teams that I think could pop Ledbetter before he gets to the Mets. But, still a decent chance he's there at 32. It's certainly in the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I mean, of all four guys that we have picked, honestly, I do like Ledbetter the most. I mean, really, I think it's between Ken's pick of Yohandri Morales and mm-hmm. Ledbetter. And I feel like Ledbetter is a more overall, maybe a higher floor player.
I mean, I have some pretty major concerns about Morales, frankly, so.
And he has very loud tools, particularly the power, but, you know, there's also the swings and misses, which is concerning.
Yep.
Whereas Ledbetter, I think, does not exhibit maybe as much power, but he doesn't have the red flags as red.
Morales, to me, just screams, like, classic college corner masher that doesn't work. And sometimes those guys do work. Like, for instance, I think the Mets were linked to Tyler Locklear a bit last year out of Virginia, if I recall correctly. And I had a very similar reaction to that of just, yeah, I do not want any part of this. Wound up with the Mariners and he's absolutely fucking destroying the ball. Like, and Pete Alonso also the same. Like, so sometimes this does work. I'm a little more skeptical of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't love the swing for Morales in particular, but, you know, whatever. He's also probably off the board by the time the Mets pick. I think some team will take him higher.
Yeah, he's kind of was like 15 to 25, I think, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I'd expect him to go there. And some places rank him significantly lower, but, you know, it only takes one team.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
If the Marlins had literally just taken Jacob Berry and now lived to regret drafting Jacob Berry, I would call him out as a Marlins pick. But I can't imagine they do it 2 years in a row. Would they?
They are the Marlins.
That would be very Marlins.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
All right. Now on to the Mets minor league affiliates. Syracuse Mets played a series against Norfolk Tides, the first place Norfolk Tides, and they had a surprisingly good series considering you know, that they are basically a 400 winning percentage team, and the Tides are like 20 games over 500. They split the series 3-3.
That's baseball, baby.
Yeah, that leaves Syracuse at 19-26, which is 12.5 games behind the Tides. But unfortunately, just like last week, Syracuse is giving up a ton of late runs. Wasn't as bad as last week, I don't think, but basically on Tuesday, the bullpen gave up 4 runs in the 9th inning, and they blew a lead, and they lost the game. And on Friday, they had to go to the bullpen early because the start of David Griffin was just horrible, and the bullpen gave up 5 runs. So
was this the week with all the cheating, too?
Oh, I completely forgot about that. That's right. We have to mention that.
It was Eric Orsi, and then who was the other dude?
The cooked guy that they signed.
Bundy yeah. Was, yeah.
So on, like, Wednesday, Dylan Bundy got ejected for sticky stuff. And then the very next day, Eric Orsi got ejected for sticky stuff. But you know what? When your team is 19-26, do what you gotta do. I do not mind it.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Speaking of sticky stuff and really funny, have you been following the exploits of one Trevor Bauer in Japan by any chance?
Not only did he get demoted to the Japanese minor leagues, but the first pitch he threw got taken out to left field.
Oh, man.
I love it.
Whatever that German word.
Schadenfreude.
There you go.
Schadenfreude. Just glorious, you know, just absolutely glorious. And to think we almost got stuck with him. Can you imagine the vibes if the Mets had signed Trevor Bauer and we were dealing with that right now? God damn.
I mean, how much did he sign the Dodgers? They signed him
40 for... million AAV, basically.
Right. That's right. Minimum, we wouldn't have one of Scherzer or Verlander.
Yeah, probably not.
Bauer would still technically would have been on the books, even though he wasn't able to play. It's would have been a mess.
Yep, it would have been a huge yeah. They really did try from all the reports, and thank Christ they didn't get that done.
Bullet avoided. Well, before we move on to Binghamton, the Syracuse Mets are also now Mark Vientalis after his call-up last Wednesday, and Ronnie Mauricio is the last one standing of the big four that started the season there. 44 games now, Mauricio is hitting .358, .393, .609, with 20 doubles, 2 triples, 7 homers, 9 steals in 13 attempts. And 9 walks to 31 strikeouts. His 64 hits lead the International League by a pretty decent margin. He has 10 more hits than the next guy. And he's also leading the league in doubles, also by a hefty margin, 6. According to a report from Tim Britton at The Athletic, the Mets are unlikely to call up Mauricio anytime soon. And he cites Mets sources as saying 2 things. They want Mauricio to, A, repeat the success that he's had against the same teams more than once, i.e. they want to see how he responds against teams that he's faced, and they kind of have like a book against him. And B, they want him to either maintain or improve his plate discipline. So what are your thoughts on that? Let's go to A. Well, let's look at A first. Repeating the success against the same teams.
I don't care. The second point is everything, frankly, yeah, to me. I mean, like,
point A is it doesn't really hold much water, especially because pitching, the league average in the International League ERA is 4.96. And on average,
the game is being played on the moon.
On average, there are 5.34 runs per game. So
One sec. I want to pull up his certain numbers here to make a point.
Sure.
But like, while you're
looking that up, basically, Syracuse, they're playing one more team that they haven't played this upcoming week. Who are they playing? The Louisville Bats. And then they go for a stretch all the way until mid-August, playing teams that they've played before. And then in mid-August, they're playing Columbus Clippers, a new team.
Who are the Clippers affiliated with? I don't actually know.
Good question. I know the Louisville Bats are the Reds. The Clippers might be the... I don't know. Clippers.
So, all right, I have the numbers in front of me. First off, let me say that, like, I don't find joy in saying that Ronnie Mauricio is not good. And also, if you as a listener or someone who read our tweets or writings was unable to discern the sarcastic hyperbole in the saying he's not a prospect, maybe touch some grass. Like, he was always obviously something of a prospect. He's just not one I was particularly fond of and not one I considered to be in our top 10. I still stand by that. But I can also admit that he has shown better exit velocity than I expected. Like, the numbers exist, as the people over at Baseball Prospectus are so fond of saying. The numbers exist to be explained, and, you know, he's getting to his power-born games. That's true. That's undeniable. He has generally a nice launch angle. He really should stop switch hitting. That remains true. And his swing decisions are still poor, right? And maybe the best thing I could do here is, and I thought of other numbers. Like he has an average exit velocity of 93.5 miles an hour. That's really good. That's a really nice top end. Like, I don't want to call it 80 power. If he did that for a whole season, that'd be like 70 grade raw power to me. Clearly, I've prepped very well for this segment, which is why I have to open three Fangraphs tabs as I talk to flesh out my argument. And it's well timed because Ronnie Mauricio is in town, or Ahmed Rosario is in town. So these are a lot of the same complaints I had about Ahmed Rosario, in that I did not think he had very good swing decisions. That wasn't the term we were using at the time, but I just did not like his approach at the plate at all. And in AAA, he hit 328, 367, 466. So it's nowhere near as much power as Mauricio, but the same sort of hyperinflated performance. He ran a really high BABIP in AAA, really nice top line numbers again in AAA, but was walking 5% of the time. And I'm sorry, that just like doesn't play. Now, Mauricio's been 20% better by weighted runs created plus at AAA than Rosario was. Absolutely true. He has better raw power than Ahmed Rosario. Also true. The swing decision issues are going to be just as problematic, if not more so. Like, no learning has occurred here. He's still walking 4.7% of the time. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. What are we doing?
I mean, everything you said is valid.
Is he a better prospect than he was at the start of the season? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he a top 100 prospect again? No. Mm-hmm. Is he a future star? No.
I think borderline top 100, he's probably in like the 100 to 125 range.
That might be fair. It's a soft top 100 right now.
Yeah. And is he a star right now? No. Will he become one? The tools are there, but I don't think that, like you said, I don't think that there's been enough learning, or there's been enough alterations in problematic swing decisions, and at this point right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing that I was looking at, where did I write it down? Like his strikeout rate, he cut down on that, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Something though that I noticed is that he has a 24.3 line drive rate, a 52% ground ball rate, and a 23.6 fly ball rate. And surprisingly, as compared to last year, the ground balls and the fly balls flip-flopped in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
He has about 10%. He has a 10% worse ground ball rate this season and a 15% fly ball rate. So it's, you know, a guy like him, you want him hitting more fly balls. We know Absolutely. That he has that. We know he has that raw plus power. And, you know, even last season when you know, it was not his best season, what did he hit? I think 26 home runs, you know?
He was pushing 30 last year. No, 26, you're right.
We know that he has the ability to harness the raw power in game. It's just, you know.
He hit 26 home runs last year, and his weighted run created plus was 104. His on-base percentage started with a 2.
Yep. But I was looking at some of the batted ball events, and this is one thing that really popped out to me and made me say, you know, they are making the right decision by not calling him up right now and maybe not calling him up for the entire season. Who knows? But a lot of the hits that he has have been ground balls.
Mm-hmm. I want to say real quick, I think I misspoke earlier when I said he has optimized launch angle. He does not have optimized launch angle. I was speaking too fast.
A lot of those hits are ground balls, and those are things that, you know, you can get, you know, in Syracuse, they're playing Norfolk. That a ball's going to get past, you know, Josh Lester is their third baseman. I couldn't tell you a thing about
Josh Lester. Who the hell is Josh Lester?
Right. And their shortstop is Joey Ortiz, which is a good baseball name. I like it. But, you know,
is Westbrook playing second base for them?
Oh. Balls that are getting past Josh Lester and Joey Ortiz are probably not getting past Nolan Arenado or Trey Turner, you know?
No, they're not.
He has 144 batted ball events in total, 75 of those, so basically 51%, have launch angles that are less than 10 degrees, which Major League Baseball defines as a ground ball. He's stinging the hell out of those balls. He has an average exit velocity of 93.7 miles per hour of all those hits. Well, excuse me, of all those batted ball events. But again, a lot of those are not going to be hits at the major league level. I counted, this is actually crazy. I counted 20 hits, not you know, balls put in play, but hits that didn't go past 90 feet. So that's, you know, home to first, home to third, 90 feet. So these are, you know, these are like dribblers, Baltimore chops, things like that. 20 of them.
Let me do some now, quick maths.
If you subtracted 20 hits from Mauricio's total right now,
mm-hmm.
which I don't have in front of me.
44 for 179. He'd be batting 250.
Right.
His on-base percentage would be in the
low threes,
yeah.
Yeah, so that looks, I mean,
awfully similar to last year all of a sudden, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's not that, you know, you can't guarantee that things like that, you know, I'm not going to say that every single one of those 20 weird ground ball hits should not be hits in the major league level, but these are looking at, you know, the numbers underneath the numbers, and I think the Mets, they could use a little bit more offense, but I don't think Mauricio would be the right guy to go to.
All right, we're going to do some more quick maths here. Let's go to, again, great radio here as I play with Fangraphs live. Batted ball. Let's sort by. All right. So, like, Ronnie Mauricio is a fast dude. Let's give him a little bit of credit. Let's say that he could run, I don't know, actually, let me go to last season so that we have a more robust sample. Like, no need to look at 2023 numbers. And if we do infield hits, you know, 10% infield hit rate would be like among the best in baseball. But let's be really generous and say that's something he could do. That probably means what, half of these 20 hits he has right now just disappear right away.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have an on-base percentage of 335, which is a vast improvement over what he's had before. And his batting average would be 280, which is nice.
Still good.
But still good. If you give him an even more normal infield hit rate, which seems justified, he very quickly gets close to 270 with a 320 on-base percentage. Again, I'm not saying that's a bad player. I kind of am, I suppose. It's a platoon bat at best, because he sure as hell can't switch hit. His right-handed swing is a disaster. And these numbers are going to get worse in the majors. Like, guys are going to exploit the fact that he makes bad swing decisions and hits everything on the ground. Teams are going to have more data. Pitchers are going to be able to hit their spots more effectively, and they're just going to pound him with the kind of stuff that he can't discern, that he shouldn't swing at. Again, he could improve. These things can change. I don't want to, like, consign him to major league irrelevance already, but these are major problems, and I don't see a sign that they've actually changed.
Right. Once, you know, I want to see the fewer ground balls, more fly balls, and that launch angle I want to see how many negatives. Oops, I closed the window here. Though there are a lot of negative launch angles. We do not want to see those negative launch angles.
Can we also comment that it's pretty concerning that this seems to be an organizational problem? Brett Beatty is hitting the ball on the ground like 50% of the time still. I was at the game on Friday, he hit a ball that I thought was like a pop up to left field, and it carried out because he has such great natural, he gets such lift on the ball anytime he gets it in the air. And he's hitting the ball on the ground 50% of the time. Ronnie Mauricio, his path to major league relevance is optimizing his launch angle and scraping by, almost like Eduardo Escobar, kind of. Like, Escobar very much has built a career on a profile of just hitting and scraping enough balls over the fence to buoy the fact that he doesn't make good swing decisions and doesn't do a whole lot else well. Like, to do that, you need to lift the ball. Jet Williams isn't lifting the ball. Jacob Reimer is killing every groundhog in the state of Florida. Like, I don't know what Kevin Parada and Alex Ramirez are doing. I haven't cared enough to look. But, like, this is who the hell in the Mets organization is not sitting these guys down and saying, look, hit the ball in the air? I don't get
it. That is a good question. Makes you wonder. Well, we'll move on now to the Binghamton Rumble Ponies. They played the Fisher Cats, New Hampshire Fisher Cats. They are the Blue Jays AA affiliate. The Columbus Clippers, by the way, they are the Cleveland Guardians AAA affiliate.
Thank you.
Binghamton, they had a halfway decent week. They are 3-2 right now, and they're starting the second game of doubleheader right now as we speak. So Binghamton possibly could even have a 4-2 week if they win, which be like their first winning week in almost a month. Basically, the last time the Brumble Ponies had a winning season. Oh, excuse me. A winning week was the end of April when they played the Acheron Rubber Ducks. But Binghamton right now, they are 17-20, possibly could be 18-20 in a few hours. Either way, doesn't really matter because they're still considerably behind the Portland Sea Dogs, either seven and a half games, whatever, depending.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really talked too much about these guys because they're not really more key names, but there's a couple of Binghamton players who are actually having surprisingly good seasons right now.
Oh, I hope you're about to bring up my main man here.
I believe so. I'll even talk about him first. Outfielder Matt Rudick.
Yeah.
He's currently hitting .306, .444, .528 in 32 games with 9 doubles, 5 homers, 5 stolen bases, and a very impressive 24 walks to 20 strikeouts.
What's that? Me overvaluing a guy with plate discipline? never happened before. He was on my original, like, long, long list of Met prospects when we were doing our top 25, and I just could not justify it. Like, there's no way this dude is the bat's gonna get knocked out of his hands. And now this year he has more homers than he's had in his entire professional career prior. He has 5 homers this year. He came into the season with 4.
That's a good percentage increase.
He's doing this with a 337 BABIP, which is high but not absurd.
No, it's a. I feel like that's a reasonable BABIP for the minor leagues. A decent hitter, and he's hitting pretty decently right now.
He's got a 170 weighted runs created play. I mean, he's 24 in Double A. I don't think he's ever even like a starter. He might just be a longside platoon bat or a bench guy, but. Why is he still in Double A right now? What are we waiting for exactly? There's the approach is excellent. Let me put it this way, right? There are things like you learn at each level. Like you can hang out at a level and improve your approach based on like what you see there. Like you're going to see new stuff, you have to learn how to approach it. He clearly knows how to do that at Double A. What he needs to improve still is his raw power, but you're not going to do that just sitting around at this level any longer. Like you can do that anywhere. Push him to AAA, because if Starling Marte pulls a hamstring, who are we calling up to take an outfielder spot? Danny Mendick,
Lorenzo Cedrola.
Yeah, okay.
DJ Stewart's season is starting.
Rudick is 24 and might be something. Can we push him a little bit? Just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, or just to bring up DJ Stewart, like he's a free agent outsider that they signed for a year. Like he's doing okay in the power department, but I think he's hitting like 180 or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, if they said, we're done with this, let's bump up Matt Rudick and see what we got here. You know, I feel like that might be a more effective use of roster space.
Yeah, absolutely. But, Let me pull up the Syracuse roster. Anyway, you had other guys you wanted to talk about. I'm just a big Matt Rudick fan, and I would pump him into the teens in the system now because I love plate discipline.
I mean, basically, all of these guys are excelling right now, and they are guys that should, hopefully, at some point this year, get some kind of look at Syracuse. The next guy, third baseman Jose Peroza, he was player of the week last week. He's currently hitting 284, 375, 545 in 24 games with the Rumble Ponies. He's got 8 doubles, 5 home runs, 11 walks, and 33 strikeouts. There's a little bit more swing and miss to his game than there is Matt Rudick, but he's 22. You know, who would you rather see get at bats, meaningful at bats in Syracuse? You know, Peroza or Jonathan Araruz, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Peroza at least just recently got promoted to St. Lucie. Got promoted to Binghamton, you know, 24 games.
He's only 22. Like, he's not. Rudick's a little older, so I'm more eager to push him up. But yeah, I wouldn't hate pushing Peroza.
If Peroza spent the entire season in Binghamton and then got, you know, a cup of coffee in Syracuse this year, I would be fine with that.
The difference there also is Peroza striking out 30% of the time.
Right. There's a bit of swing, and he's never really displayed the power that he's showing this year. I mean, last week, I think he had 5 home runs last week. That's a good week. And the other guy, again, why are we running out Bobby Rossman every couple of days in the bullpen when we could have Dylan Hall? He's appeared in 9 games for Binghamton. He's thrown a total of 13.2 innings. He has not allowed a run yet with Binghamton. He's scattered 9 hits. He's walked 4 and he struck out 14. He started the year at Syracuse. He was rostered at Syracuse and then he was sent down and he's perfect. You know, we know that Syracuse has had some bullpen problems.
Question is Hall using sticky stuff?
Someone needs to introduce him to the sticky stuff then. And he's only striking out 14. He's only striking out basically 9 per 9 innings. So I would say there's probably not a lot of sticky stuff there.
No, most likely not.
It's Brooklyn Cyclones now. They played the Hudson Valley Renegades, the Yankees High A affiliate, and they had the best week of their season. They, I think, might have had the best week of any Mets affiliate this year, which is sad. They are 4-1 right now. They're playing the second game of a doubleheader, so they could conceivably go 5-1 if they win it. Mm-hmm. 15-20 on the season. Whatever reason, I don't know. Everything seems to have clicked for Brooklyn this week. Blaise Tidwell threw 5 innings in his start. He didn't allow an earned run. He gave up 4 hits. He walked 5 and struck out 8. Not great, but I'll take it, especially considering his last like 2 starts have been kind of like catastrophic.
Yes.
Cameron Foster, he threw 9 innings. Excuse me, he threw 6 innings. Did not now allow a earned run. He gave up 4 hits. He walked 3. He struck out 5. Serviceable. Yoandy Suarez, he threw 5 innings. He allowed 1 run, scattered 4 hits, walked 2, struck out 6. Again, serviceable. And Tyler Stewart, who was having a very strong season, he threw 6-plus scoreless innings. He walked 1, and he struck out 8. So all week, Brooklyn's had good starting pitching. And finally, the bats are, like, starting to come around. Kevin Pryor kind of is waking up. He went 5-for-20 with a home run, a walk. Alex Ramirez went 5-for-18 with 3 doubles, a home run, 4 walks. Stanley Consuegra missed a couple of games, but he's 3-for-13 with 2 doubles. William Lugo, 3-for-15 and 2 stolen bases. Chase Estep went 4-for-11 with 2 doubles and a triple. Kevin Kendall went 3-for-14 with 2 doubles and a steal, 2 walks. You know, maybe not the best, you know, a lot of 3-for-15s, 3-for-14s, maybe not the greatest average, but, you know, the guys are hitting for some power. They're timely hits. They're doing other things. They're hitting for extra bases. They're stealing bases. They're walking. So it's good that some of these guys that are struggling, particularly Parada and Ramirez, are maybe waking up. It would be nice if this is kind of like the spark to get these guys back on track because, you know, we are almost 2 months into the season now, and it's particularly Parada, you know, is not doing well.
No, they need to tweak his swing. You did leave out some of the good news for the Cyclones that I'm very interested in.
Ooh, which is?
Dylan DeBrock is back.
That's right. He was on the the injured list.
Injured list, yes.
He's been activated now.
Yeah, he made like 1 good 3-inning start in April, disappeared for 1.5 months, and is now working out of the bullpen. Struck out three of the four batters he faced. What is that? Yesterday? No, that was on Friday. So,
right.
I still like him a lot. But I'm glad. I mean, like when he disappeared for a month, I'm like, oh boy, here we go.
When guys disappear for months on end, is not good. But he's another guy that it would be nice. You know, I'm looking at a guy like Tyler Stewart. He is, what was he? I think he was like a 13th round pick last year, or 12th, something like that. 8th, maybe. I don't really recall. But he was not a marquee name. And here he is at this point in time right now. He has a 113 ERA in 32 innings.
Did any of us call him as a break? I don't remember us talking about him at all before the season. Maybe I'm misremembering, but
no,
yeah, oh, he was this sixth came out of nowhere. Yeah.
I mean, he was only through like limited innings last year. He was drafted out of Southern Mississippi, you know, not a big time, you know, baseball program or anything like that. So he might be a diamond in the rough. That would be nice. And that's something that the Mets system seriously needs and that they've been lacking is those pop-up guys that kind of come out of nowhere and all of a sudden establish themselves as, like, dependable players.
Yep.
And finally, St. Lucie Mets. They played the Palm Beach Cardinals. They went 2-5, which leaves them at 10-29 on the season, 14 games behind the Cardinals. Yeah, it didn't really sink in until I was doing the farm report Saturday night. At the time, they were 9-29. Basically, we have like a week, you know, they're 10-29 now, but basically there's a week left to go in the month of May, and they've won 10 games. Their win on Saturday, it snapped a 9-game losing streak. They've won 4 games this entire month. They have 2 wins in a row now, which is their longest winning streak since the beginning.
Oh, wow. Wow. It is,
yeah. Hey, you know when the last time they did when they won 2 games in a row?
Last season?
Beginning of April, they won 3 whole games in a row against the Jupiter Hammerheads in the second series of the season. So maybe they'll match that when they play on Tuesday. The pitching in St. Lucie, no one is doing particularly great. The main names on the hitting side, Jet Williams and Jacob Raymer, they're still having funky seasons. Jet's hitting 207, 409, 293. And Raymer's hitting 224, 355, 302. They're both very passive at the plate. They're not hitting for much power. Jet has 5 extra base hits total and a 0.89 ISO. And he's averaging 88.7 miles per hour exit velocities. And Jacob Raymer also has 5 hits, extra base hits.
His 5 ISO, hits.
Yeah. Oh, that would not be good. His ISO is 0.78. And he's averaging an exit velocity of 88.3 miles an hour. So,
I mean, the funny thing is these are decent exit velocity numbers for their age and level. They're just hitting everything on the ground.
Yeah, that's like you said all the way at the beginning, is the amount of ground balls is just not good. And Jet is a guy that we know has pop. So does Raymer. And they shouldn't be posting 0.89 and 0.78 ISOs.
No, they should not.
I mean, that's basically all that needs to be said, is the minimum of 100. Like, come on, guys.
I'm like still pretty high on both of them, frankly.
Yeah, I was going to say, like we kind of said, I'm assuming that we said this last week, we probably have said this a couple of times, regardless of what they do, I don't think that we're going to get into the, even if they end the season right now, Jet hitting 207, 409, 293, and Raymer hitting 224, 355, 302. I don't think that we're ever going to get to that level of concern because, you know, Jet is 18 and Raymer is 19, or vice versa, I forget. But they're both playing getting their first taste of professional baseball. The Florida State League is more like the New York Penn League now. There's, you know, there's a large number of, you know, college guys and international free agents who have had a couple of years in the foreign leagues to get their feet wet. So throwing 2 guys right out of high school baseball into the Florida State League is a bit of a jump. So, you know, Jet, I think his WRC plus is a little over 100, and Raymer is a little under 100. That's, you know, it's fine. It's not what I don't think any of us would have wanted. You know, we both would have wanted to see them hit over 300 and just dominate and get promoted to Brooklyn at the age of 18 and 19. Sure, but you know, very unrealistic to happen to begin with. And the fact that they're doing what they're doing now is, you know, they're doing okay, and that's enough for right now.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, look, I was, my bold predictions are probably sunk, but I'm still quite high on both of them as players.
Yeah, and you know what? We still have a few months of the season to go. For all we know, the coaching and St. Lucie could just be telling them, listen, learn the strike zone, see what it's like to get thrown a decent changeup, a decent slider, a decent curveball, soak it all in, and in June, now go ham, you know? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Stuff like, yep. You know, it is a developmental league. And yep. Stuff like that does happen. So,
I mean, there's a non-zero chance that these guys might have been at rookie ball this year if that was still a thing. Like, there's now no middle ground between extended spring training and A ball. So, and I've stated my concerns about the Mets hitting development practices. But on pure talent, I still quite like both of these players.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All of the stuff that we liked about them over the offseason is, all that is still in play, regardless of what the numbers are when the season is done and over. All right, so that is the show for the week. If anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you can send us an email at our email address from complexthequeens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Sipa. Lucas is at elvlahos343. Ken is at kenlevin91. And Thomas is at sadmethseason, SZN. Mm-hmm. Subscribe to the podcast, wherever you get your podcast from, rate and review. And of course, we thank you for listening. And a reminder that we are now a Patreon-based podcast. So if you like this one, if you like any of the other ones in the Homer and Apple network, you can subscribe for $5 a month, and you'll get bonus content like extra episodes and exclusive content. So we will be back next week. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.